come alive. I won't feel so lonesome and blue. But it's awfully hard to laugh and smile for you now.
That was Jimmy Rushing, and we opened that set with Betty Carter singing Social Call. It's 10 minutes to 3 o'clock. I'm one of the many people who spent part of the morning on my sick days and my days off last fall sitting in front of the television watching the David Letterman Show, a cynical and very funny program of monologues, sketches, and interviews that would have been considered daring in a late night spot and was quite outrageous in the morning. You'll recall that David Letterman was a special favorite of Fred Silverman and was, word had it, being groomed to be the next host of The Tonight Show. A lot of us wondered why his show was on in the morning when programming is expected to be cheerful and tame. Letterman seemed concerned about how long the show would last himself, and I remember he had his Christmas show on in the fall, just in case the program was canceled before December 25th, which it was. Those of you who work and didn't get sick days last fall to stay home and watch Letterman on television may have seen him on The Tonight Show, where he's become one of the most popular substitutes for Johnny Carson. He's in Philadelphia to perform tonight and tomorrow night at the Bijou. David Letterman, it's really a very special treat to meet you. And
thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, Terry.
Can you compare what you can do on morning television and what you could do like on evening television on the Tonight Show? Do they lay it out for you? Do you get memos about what you can and can't do?
Well, I don't think it's that specific. I think it what you can do in the morning as opposed to what you can do at night is not so much dictated by the time of day as the particular show. The Tonight Show generally considers itself to be an entertainment show and therefore would not want to do political interviews or things of that nature. And they've been quite successful at it. In the morning, chances are you would not want to do things, let's say on the Phil Donahue show, chances are you're not going to do stand-up comedy. Again, it's more of a function of that show that dictates than it is the time of day. At least that's what I thought. Other people think that in the mornings it's got to be housewife stuff because housewives are home and they're the only people to turn on television before 5 in the afternoon. And I never really believed that. And even if it was true, it was always my desire to give them the option of something other than nail care hints and makeup and what to do with leftovers and so forth and horoscopes and gossip. I'm not sure that I answered your question.
No, that's fine. Are there any examples of things, though, that nevertheless you weren't able to do on the morning show because of its time spot, that you had to store away for another time?
No. We pretty much did everything we wanted to do. We and most of what we did, we didn't consider to be outrageous for the time of day. So if we had a show late at night, maybe what we do would all be different. But for that particular project, there was nothing that anybody said you cannot do. There were things that they would like to seen us do that we did not do. But it was
like what?
Music, for example. It was my desire to have this show be a forum and a place that appealed to people who generally did not perform on television, music acts. And NBC would rather we not had music, period, and if we did have, they wanted it to be pretty much commercial, middle of the road, you know, which, so that was one thing. But as far as executing any kind of curious concept, nobody ever came to us and said, stop doing this.
What's the sketch or the moment that you're most satisfied with looking back?
The final 2 months of the show got to be a great deal of fun, and it was kind of a dream where you, you know, you always hear people say this and you never fully believe it, but I experienced it and believed it and believe it now. You really look forward to going to work in the morning. But my favorite situation was a relationship we developed with a gentleman who was in his early 70s who lives in Collins, Missouri, named Floyd Stiles, who is a retired grade school janitor, part-time farmer, and country, not gentleman in the purest sense of the term, but a gentleman who lives in the country nonetheless. And we came to know him through an article about him in a newspaper from Collins, Missouri, which is about 500 in population. And one thing led to another, and we phoned him on the air one morning and chatted with him, and we ended up bringing him and his wife to New York, and we turned it into Floyd Stiles Day. And it was the theme of the show. And it was so interesting how you can create your own sort of special activities. It was the same when we did the Christmas show on September 9th. Suddenly, because we made it the Christmas show, it might as well have been Christmas. And the same was true with Floyd Stiles Day. It suddenly became an event. And it was just one of those neat little things because he played along. He knew it was a joke, but yet he had such dignity that we really couldn't make fun of him, which was great. And
I think you really have a gift for that, for using people in the audience or, you know, people, men on the street type people or something, without making fun of them. I mean, they're a part of it. The joke's not on them.
You have to be careful because if you do cross that line, then you've lost friends, you know, because nobody really wants to be the brunt of a joke. So it's a delicate line, and unfortunately, you do occasionally bloody somebody's nose inadvertently, but it was never our intent. But Floyd turned out to be a great guy, and it was fun. And I think that was my favorite occurrence on the show.
I once saw two people getting married on the Merv Griffin show, and I thought it was one of the most bizarre things I'd ever witnessed, and wondered really what had led them to participate in that.
I don't know. That's not a bad notion, I guess. I'm all for anything that calls attention to itself like that. I think Andy Kaufman has refined this to a really annoying science, and I'm a big supporter of his. I think he's dangerous and probably won't one day take lives, but I more power to him. I think it's just great to see anything, to see something different occurring on television, you know.
What do you think is dangerous about Kaufman? Do you think he's a danger to himself or to others? I wonder if he's got a personality of his own or if he's always just becoming personas.
No, I think Andy knows what he's up to, and I think he may go home at the end of the day and look in the mirror and just sort of laugh slyly to himself because he's hoodwinked the public. But I wasn't serious about him being dangerous. But again, I think the criticism he receives, and it's certainly not my position to be criticizing a fellow performer, but it's like what we were talking about. Do you either include someone in on the joke or exclude them? And I think Andy, even with a gun to his head, would not include you in the joke. You know, he would rather make fools of everyone. Still, in all, it makes for interesting television.
You sub frequently for Johnny Carson, and the audience always seems so giddy during a monologue. I wonder what the warm-up's like for the Tonight Show audience.
Well, the warm-up for the Tonight Show audience is the 19 years that show has been on the air and has become part of American television and probably more typifies American TV than any other entity. And that's why it's that way. It's largely tourists and people who have save their nickels and dimes, and people who are not lucky enough to be married on the Merv Griffin show all come to the Tonight Show. And so they're ready for an event. And if you see something going awry on the Tonight Show, it is certainly never the fault of the audience because the audience will give you every benefit of the doubt. And I've lost a few battles, so I know, I know what it's like. But they're always terrific.
When you do one of those asides about how a joke's not working or something, do you usually feel it because it's not?
Oh, sure. It's very difficult to do. Johnny Carson has made the monologue on The Tonight Show an art form, and he does it better than anyone will ever do it. So by filling in for him, the comparison is always obvious, and you always come up second best. Now, the kind of material he does night after night after night is not the kind of material that a comedian necessarily develops for his act. There are two different kinds of things. He can come out and make jokes about the band. He can come out and make jokes about Burbank. And this sort of stuff is fine. But chances are it would not work to a random audience of folks in Las Vegas or Philadelphia or whatever. So it's when I started as a stand-up comedian, I developed that kind of material as opposed to Tonight Show kind of material. Now, when you do the Tonight Show, you suddenly have to find yourself coming up with just something that'll get by. And it's always a very difficult task for me to assemble it.
Well, how much do you come up with for your, you know, by yourself for the monologue, and how much is done by writers?
It depends. I use some writers, it just depends. Sometimes the writers supply a lot if they're on a hot streak, and if not, you've paid several hundred dollars for typing paper. And the same is true with me. Sometimes, like the last time I had a funny idea was in the late 50s, so it's been a cold season for me.
How do you work it up? Because sometimes, you know, I figure, well, how much time do you have to actually get the monologue in your head before you're out there on stage having to do it?
Well, I being one of the great procrastinators, wait till the very last minute and assemble it And this somehow excites me because I realize that I've got something fresh here to perform in a matter of moments as opposed to rehearsing and so forth. My real problem is I'm lazy, and I'll do a million other things before I sit down and start writing jokes, and I will wax the dog and vacuum the floor or whatever, just because I don't like sitting in front of a typewriter trying to work.
Is it on a teleprompter or anything? There's times I swear, not you, but Carson, when I could swear that I see him reading his jokes when he gets on there.
This is the way I do it. I'll show you here. I'm diagramming something for her. There is a art card. The dimensions of this would be roughly that way. And there would be, say I was going to do a joke about you. T-E-R-R-I?
If it's a joke with a Y.
Okay. Then I was going to do a joke about Philadelphia. So I've put Terry's name on top. Then I've put Philadelphia. Then say I was going to do a joke about my dog. I would put Bob. And that's what I work on. Just.
So you just have the names there?
Yeah, and then I would have a gentleman holds that up for me, and so.
What if you forget the joke?
Doesn't make any difference. It's just television.
What are some of the ripple effects you've seen of yourself being on just television? Because when I think of all the millions of people who particularly watch The Tonight Show, what all over the world maybe, do you get like strange feedback?
And
they're being taken really seriously.
There are some occurrences. There are. Not a great deal. People, by and large, are very nice, and it's flattering if somebody will make a specific comment about something that you did. Well, the thing that I enjoy is the show that we did on NBC, which was canceled. People still talk about it, and that's always nice. I enjoy that when they come up and they say, I remember on your show you did, and then they'll cite something specifically. And that always makes me feel good as opposed to, we saw you on The Tonight Show, and something. The generic sort of mysterious comment is always baffling, you know. I said, yeah, saw you Friday night. And then you're left wondering, well, what does that mean exactly? did they like you? Did they hate you? But I'm always happy when somebody mentions the show.
You had mentioned that Carson always can make jokes about the band and everything. One of your running gags on your show was the band is cooking. joke in which they'd walk out with like shish kebabs on the piano and things. So
it was, and I'm not proud of that from a humor standpoint.
Why?
It was so stupid. I was proud that we did it. I was generally proud of the show because we'd try it once, and it was such a silly joke. It was just the lowest pun, and we compounded it by doing it three or four times. But it was fun, and that's the thing that I'm most proud of, is we created an atmosphere, I think, that where you really didn't, although it was an illusion more than an atmosphere, where you were not sure what was going to happen next, and so that was fun.
I think television wasn't ready for you.
No, television was. Actually, the show was doing quite well toward the end, but it was a matter of mathematics, and it's a long, silly discussion, but we just found ourselves in an equation which was insurmountable. It was not a difficult decision. It was an easy decision. If you were in business and you add up your liabilities and your pluses, you know, and you act accordingly. So it was not a difficult decision for them.
Is there a generation gap between comedians? And I'm thinking of the kinds of comedians who make jokes like, hey, nowadays you can't tell the difference between the boys and the girls, and my wife, she's so stupid, and jokes like that.
Well, there seems to be, but then again, I think there is an arena for each of those styles of comedy. And the people who are doing, it's very unusual, for example, to see a 19 or a 20-year-old guy doing jokes about, my wife is so fat that when she sits around the house, her head explodes, or whatever that joke is. But it's not unusual to see someone in their mid-60s still doing jokes about these kids today. And there is a gap, a fissure, but I don't know exactly why, except I think that with more and more competition and as the state of the art has improved, there may have been some. I don't want to say that those other forms of jokes lacked intelligence, but I think that just the more you do something, the better the product gets, and I think that's what's happened.
Did any comedians from that school ever give you advice about how to polish a routine and what kind of jokes to include?
Well, there are certain of those guys and women that. I think I do know what the difference is. Those people never had the benefit of working toward a media goal. They were working in cheap bars and Greyhound depots. There's certainly nothing wrong with Greyhound depots, but they had to work everywhere, and this is how they made their living. They had no hope of getting on the Merv Griffin Show because the Merv Griffin Show was not around. So if you wanted to be a comic, you did what would get you over under 99% of the conditions. And as a result, they selected the lowest common denominator. Now it's different. A guy thinks he's funny. He drops out of high school, moves to Los Angeles, prepares 5 minutes, appears on the Merv Griffin Show, and thinks he'll get a situation comedy. And it's happened, and it will continue to happen. So the gap, I think, is a result of the guys who began were doing it to survive. These were real fighters. They were in it for the long haul. And they would do the kind of material that would quickly establish themselves as being funny, and they could sustain it, and it could go on forever because they were really doing it for a living. The other guys are looking to get into television situations, and I think maybe that's the difference.
Did you ever have to write for comedians whose sensibility you didn't feel really in sync with?
The first gentleman I actually wrote for was Jimmy Walker, who was a comic who was the star of a television show called Good Times and who is black. And I think he may have been the first black person I ever saw. So it was difficult for me to – we would go to meetings, and Jimmy was quite generous because I had just moved from Los Angeles and had no money to speak of, and he hired me to write with him and some other people. And it was funny, and sitting there – pretending that I knew the first thing about what it's like to grow up in a ghetto situation was silly in itself. But it wasn't so much that our sensibilities were out of sync as it was he wanted personal anecdotes from his past to get his laughs with, and it was tough for me to, I had grown up in the middle of Indianapolis, and so that was interesting.
Did you ever have to write for someone like Bob Hope, who's probably always in search of young talent?
I did write for Bob Hope once. It was a wonderful experience. I wrote for a show that he was doing from Perth, Australia. And he had about half a dozen writers, the mean age of whom I guess would be about 90. And Perth, Australia, in all the research that I did, and the producer of the show was actually an Australian. And for 3 weeks, everybody told me how great it was in Perth in the summertime because they said the beaches are the most spectacular places in the world and they're just covered with lovely women. And so I was looking forward to going to Perth. Well, they took the three or four 90-year-old writers who mentioned that they probably wouldn't be leaving the hotel room and left me back in L.A. And I wrote and wrote for days and days and days and never knew what became of the show. And I was in Canada the night that it aired, and I turned it on and actually heard Bob doing one of my jokes, and I thought, well, this is certainly a milestone to have Bob Hope do a joke that I have written.
What was the joke?
I don't remember. It was a Bob Hope joke, which I think was probably prefaced with, but I want to tell you, and I think may have ended up with, but seriously, and in between, I'm not sure what the joke was.
Do you have to start thinking like him if you're writing for someone like that?
Yeah, you do. You can hear his voice, and he's been on television and in movies for years, so it's not that difficult. You know, it's so that was fun.
What do you look for in writers?
It's difficult. Good writers, as it turns out, I guess this probably comes as no surprise to you. They're difficult to come by. People who. You look for somebody who sort of is maybe a smarter version of yourself or a more prolific version of yourself. And that's always difficult because I guess it's personal taste then more than anything. But I like people who can write good jokes. I think I have a lot of admiration for somebody who can still craft a real tight piece of humor. But again, most of the newer guys are looking, they want to write a one-day-at-a-time script or my sister Edna and sell it to Norman Lear so they can retire in Bel Air. And there's not really any money to be made writing jokes, So it's tough.
How did you plot your path to discovery? I'm sure you had some kind of plan in mind about how you'd get noticed and start to make a career for yourself?
Well, it becomes, I think everybody who is interested in comedy is now aware of places like the Improvisation in New York and in Los Angeles and the Comedy Store in Los Angeles. And so you figure that by performing there often enough that lightning will one day strike and you'll suddenly be a star. So that generally seemed to be, you know, it looked like that would work because it had worked before and, you know, you give it a shot. But as far as specifically pinpointing this and that, no, I never did.
What do you do if it doesn't work? I mean, what kind of careers are there for comedians?
Well, you can, if you don't get yourself established in films or television, there's, like we talked about earlier, the long haul. You can spend the rest of your life working Holiday Inns and conventions, and only a handful of guys work Las Vegas. The economy and the situation in Las Vegas and every place else now, if you don't draw customers, you're really of no use to anybody anymore.
Yeah.
Whereas before in Las Vegas and Lake Tahoe and so forth, they would have a headliner and then a comic could open the show. And I think they still do, but you're not going to get any money that way. It's going to be a tough struggle. You've got to, like David Brenner, I think, would be one of the few new comics who draws. You know, he draws incredibly well, so he gets paid commensurately.
You must have been starting to work during the comedy drought of the 1960s when there didn't seem to be any comedians. Sometimes I think the people maybe thought they were too hip for comedians then. Really, I just can't think of any who were around.
Mid-60s. There were... It seemed to me like the Fire Sign Theater. I think they passed for comedy in those days. I don't mean that in a in a negative way. And then was that? I guess George Carlin was getting out of his suits and looking like a dirty hitchhiker. I don't know who else would have. I think Richard Pryor was in transition then, or maybe that was before. I'm not sure. I was busy at Ball State University in the mid-60s and participating in panty raids and other worldly matters.
Were you really?
Oh, yeah.
You had a pretty traditional college life?
Traditional. It was odd that it was so traditional. For that period of time, I went to school in 1965 and finally graduated in 70. And I think the biggest, this was amid, Berkeley and the huge campus demonstrations and people were suddenly either really aware or just pretending they were aware. And the only big upheaval we had at Ball State, we had a huge sit-in once. We were protesting. We thought the cooks ought to wear hairnets. And that was the extent of our big protest. I think we lost, by the way.
who were your favorite comedians when you were becoming aware of comedy?
Well, there was a, you know, when I was really a young person, I liked Jonathan Winters. He could just make me laugh under any circumstance. And Johnny Carson, I thought, was very funny. He used to do an afternoon show where he'd make fun of all odd manner of folks. Steve Allen, I thought, was wonderful. I still think both of these guys are wonderful. Richard Pryor, at the time, I liked and have gotten and still like. The best person in a nightclub situation now is Bill Cosby. It's just unbelievable what this man is capable of doing. And he doesn't really tell jokes per se, but he comes out on a stage and sits down in a chair. And this is interesting because the purpose of your appearance there, you have to dominate this group, and to dominate and control from a seated position is interesting. And he does it, and he is unbelievable. And I would guess he would be the best in a nightclub situation now. And then there are, you know, the newer guys. Steve Martin is just a phenomenon. You know, it goes on and on. Then I have my own peers who I think are great. There's a guy, Jay Leno, who I think is probably the best new, not so new, but best at really observational material. And there's others, you know.
Do people send you jokes in the mail,
yeah,
hoping you'll tell them?
Yeah, yeah. And generally, there's nothing there.
Nothing funny, you mean?
Yeah, generally.
Are there ones that you've heard before?
They're not so much ones that you've heard before, but they're ones that the other people have... something funny happened at the hardware store when Virgil dropped the bandsaw blade. And, you know, and you go, oh, that's great. You know, tell that to the Hardware Association convention folks, but generally, the stuff that you get unsolicited, there's not much there.
Would you tell it if there was?
Sure. Yeah, because it's, like I said before, it's so difficult to accumulate really good material. And if you find something great, it'll be with you for the rest of your life.
Do comedians steal material from one another?
Yes, yeah. And it's about the only rule in stand-up comedy. You know, you're not supposed to do it. It's as close to being immoral as that immoral group of people can generate. You shouldn't do it because it takes forever to get this stuff, especially when you're starting. And to do it, take somebody's material and do it on a television show is the worst. Now, if you find out that Billy Bibson is doing your joke up in New Jersey somewhere, you know, you don't much care. But if suddenly Billy Bibson gets his own variety show and he's doing your joke, then you've got reasons for it. But it goes on and continues to go on, and there's nothing you can do about it. You shouldn't do it, though.
Let me just change the subject completely for a moment. I've always really admired your teeth. Because they're imperfect teeth, and people are rarely allowed on TV unless they can do toothpaste commercials or something.
That's right.
It's really distinctive to...
It's a federal code, actually. Your teeth have to meet certain minimum dental standards. It was one of those deals where my parents, although not poor, did not have enough money. I don't know why I'm even telling this, because it's what happens in everybody's family. My sister had worse teeth than I, and they thought, well, if we don't fix her teeth, we're never going to unload her. That sounds terrible. I don't mean it that way. But she was more conscious of her dental situation than I, so they had her teeth fixed. Now, people who've never seen me probably think, gee, the man just must look like a backhoe or something. I have spaces between my teeth and an overbite.
Oh, but it's great. It's like a real person's mouth. Well, good. Have you had to, like, turn down parts for crazy made-for-TV movies or just crazy schemes that people have for TV shows or movies that you really don't think would work for you? And how do you judge what's good and what's not?
Well, I'm in a position now where I don't have to say yes to everything. Which is great. But in the beginning, when you're first starting out, you're so grateful for the experience and also for the money that you are less selective, of course. But here lately, what you soon find out again, like the jokes, is there's not much real exciting, interesting stuff being, at least it's not being offered to me. That's not to say that it's not around. But in the beginning, you do other things. I used to be on game shows as a host, not as a host, but as a guest. I actually hosted a pilot for a game show. The guy flew me to New York, and at the time I had a girlfriend who was living in New York, and I thought, well, it's a free trip to New York. So I went in, and then they offered me the show and said, think it over. So when I got home, I felt so guilty because he had paid for the flight to New York and the hotel room, and my girlfriend and I went out to eat and charged it to these folks with their expense money. And I thought, well, now I better do the show. I mean, I had no real interest in doing the show, but I felt so guilty about it that I did it. And you do stuff like that. Unfortunately, it never saw the light of day. But
what was the show?
The show was called, I believe it was called The Riddlers, R-I-D-D-L-E-R-S. And it was a game show, and each of the celebrity guest contestants was Joanne Worley, I believe. And that was it. And for 30 minutes, we gave away patio furniture or something. I don't know.
Do you think that the cable is going to offer a lot of opportunities?
I don't know. I think it will. Everybody keeps saying that it's the thing of the future, and hang on. We fully don't understand the ramifications of... And I guess I don't. I think... Trying to look at it objectively, what's going to happen is there will be more openings to be filled by the same people who are filling them now. Therefore, it's possible that the product, if you can believe this or not, that we see on commercial television will start being watered down as it is stretched to fill more and more holes. Now, that may not be true, but it could be. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So it doesn't sound like you're...
I don't know yet.
You think it's too promising?
Well, it's exciting, certainly. I just was hooked up to cable where I live, and I was so disappointed because I thought I was going to get to see all manner of exotic programming from all over the North American continent, and all I get is bad movies. It's just nonstop awful movies, so I'm a little disappointed.
Which coast are you living on now?
I'm in New York, yes. Yeah, I lived in New York for about 8 months, and I'm back there now.
Which coast do you prefer?
I like living in New York City. If you're going to be living and working, New York City is the place to be living and working. If you're on vacation for 6 or 7 years, California is the place to be on vacation because that's all that is out there. People on vacation for sick. They, you know, they take a decade off and move to California, and that's what they do.
Well, I really want to thank you for talking with us. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, I enjoyed being here. It was a lot of fun, and you're very interesting to talk.